Our second class today by Brother Jim is entitled At the Judgment Seat of Christ. Brother Jim Cowie.
Thank you, Brother Ron. Sorry for the staccato start there. Well, brothers and sisters, we come now to speak of the matter of the judgment seat of Christ. And of course, this is where it becomes very sobering for each one of us, because none of us will escape this. We're all going to have to make our appearance there at the judgment seat, and we're going to have to pass to right or left. But how do we get there? How do we get to the judgment seat? Now, tomorrow morning, God willing, we're going to be talking about three passages in the Old Testament which will demonstrate to us very, very plainly that Sinai will be the place of judgment. There's no question about that. It's incontrovertible when you put the evidence together. But how do we get there? Man's transport or God's? Now, most of us, of course, got here today by travelling in vehicles of one kind or another. There's a sensation of travel, isn't there? You're rumbling along the road and you see things going by. We know that pretty well. It happens every day in our lives. Well, it's going to be different, brethren and sisters, quite different. Think about this. In Matthew 18, verse 10, the Lord Jesus Christ said, "The angels behold the face of my Father in heaven." They're before his face. But these are the same angels who are sent forth by Christ to minister to heirs of salvation. In Psalm 34, verse 7, it says that the angels of Yahweh encamp about those who fear him. How can they be in two places at one time? Well, they can't. But you see, the angels can transfer from heaven to earth to be in the presence of the Father and back to be in our presence in a moment of time, in less than a wink of an eye. Now, that is a totally new experience for us, is it not? It'd be nice if I could come from Australia to North America in the wink, in a moment. That'd be great, but it's, 13 hours across the Pacific and then many hours to get here. You see, brethren and sisters, the closest star to the Earth is Alpha Centauri. It's 4.3 light years away, which means that if you travel at 186,000 miles per second, or if you come from Canada or Australia, 297,600 kilometres per second, then you would only get to the closest star after 4.3 years at that speed. God lives in the heaven of heavens. We don't know where, but we do know this, that men have created these huge telescopes that can see out, and it just keeps going and going and going. Where does God live in that? I don't know. But wherever he is, the angels come backwards and forwards from where he lives to the earth in a moment of time. And that is how you and I are going to judgment. How do we know that? Well, we know it because we've got some testimony about that. We know that immortal travel is not dependent on gravity or physical exertion. We won't go to the passage. We know in Luke 24:36 that Christ just appeared in the room to his disciples. No doors were open. How does that happen? Well, there are examples of mortal transfer like that as well. We got the case of John chapter 6, verses 16 to 21, and I think you are familiar with the record. It's the time when Jesus came walking on the sea, remember? A violent storm had caused the disciples to cry out, and then Jesus came unto them walking on the sea. "Fear not," he said. And when he entered the boat, it was a dead calm. Then, the record says, they were immediately at the land. Whither they went? Now, they're out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. It's got to be several miles. We don't know exactly the distance. But there's a boat with 13 men in it that all of a sudden is no longer in the middle of the sea. It's immediately at the land whither they went. Now, of course, it's all a parable. The land or the place whither they went was Capernaum, the city of comfort. It's parabolic of the ecclesia being buffeted in the sea of nations, which, of course, is our state today, isn't it? Buffeted, blown him, and Jesus comes walking on the sea.
and we will be immediately at the land whither we go. We'll be at Sinai, at the foot of the land, and that will be part of Abraham's territory when it's given to him. Okay? We're not going to have a packed bag and climb into a 747 and go through security. And forget that, brethren and sisters. We will be there. 1 minute here, the angels knock on the door. They'll tell us what to do exactly. Next second, feet standing on the plain before Mount Horeb. Think about that. It's going to happen. It's happened to others, you know. It happened to others. It happened to Philip, for instance, in Acts chapter 8, 39 and 40, we read this. That Philip, after having baptized the eunuch, he's directed by the Spirit to meet the Ethiopian eunuch, and somewhere down here in the wilderness, we don't know exactly where, he meets the eunuch, baptizes him, and then the record says in verse 40, he is caught away. Now that word caught away happens to be the word used in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 17. We shall be caught away together with them to meet the Lord in air. Remember? Same word. So Philip is just picked up. The next thing he knows, he's in Ashdod. Got to be 20 miles, 25 miles away at least from where he was. He didn't have any sensation, sort of, oh, that's nice down there, isn't it? He ended up, the next second, in Ashdod. So that's how it will happen to us. Consider also, of course, the case of Enoch and Elijah, both of whom were translated, transferred to somewhere else. Picked up, put down somewhere else. So that, I believe, is the way that we will shortly be removed from our current circumstances and find ourselves assembled amongst millions of other people, all of whom held responsible for the judgment seat of Christ. What about the order of judgment then, brethren and sisters? I want you to come to Matthew chapter 20, not too far away from where we've just read. We have a parable which is in the context of the establishment of the kingdom. It really begins this context in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 27, where Peter asks the question, we've forsaken all. What shall we have therefore? And Jesus says, in the regeneration when the Son of Man shall sit in the throne of his glory. I want you to notice that, throne of his glory. He shall also sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. He goes on to talk about the benefits of the present. Everyone that hath forsaken houses or brethren or sisters would receive 100-fold, he says, and shall inherit everlasting life. And then he says this, but many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first. And cast your eye across to Matthew chapter 20 and verse 16. It says this, so the last shall be first, and the first last. So you see, between those two statements, the one in chapter 19 verse 30 and the one in chapter 20 verse 16, you've got a parable. We know the context. It's about the setting up of the kingdom, the dispensing of rewards, starting with the apostles. Okay, so that's the context. It's very important for us. This first last principle we're going to see is very useful to us. Those who are called last appear first for reward, do they not? Now, why would this be the case? Well, we're going to see it's to do with practicalities. The parable, though, we know, don't we? Here's the parable of a man who goes out to seek labourers for his vineyard. You notice in verse 1, it says he goes out early in the morning, just like God said to his people through the prophets, I rose early in the morning and I sent prophets to you. In verse 2 it says, and when he had agreed with the labourers for a penny, that is, these were living under law, there was an agreement. All that Yahweh hath spoken, we will do and be obedient, they said. They had an agreement under law. But what about the Gentiles? Well, they come along in verse 3. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace and said unto them, go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right I will give you. In other words, that required trust. He didn't say, well, look, I'll give you a penny. He said, Whatever is right, you had to have faith. You had to trust that this man would do the right thing. Different basis, isn't it? The ones in verse 2 are under law. There's an agreement. These are under faith. And of course, we know there are several times he goes out until we get down to verse 6 at about the 11th hour. I don't think there's any doubt that we're those in the 11th hour, brethren and sisters. Those in the 11th hour, at 5 p.m. in the afternoon, he goes out to find more labourers. And he brings them in and says, whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive. When it comes time to dispense the rewards, who does he start with? He starts with those who came at the end of the day. Guess what that's telling us, brethren and sisters? We, those of us who are alive and remain, those of us in the 11th hour period, are going to come before Christ first. And he'll work back to Adam. Right back to the beginning. Now, won't it be interesting? It'll certainly be interesting to those on the right-hand side to watch as groups of people, and this is how it's going to happen, there's no question about this, groups of people will be brought in contemporary periods, contemporary generations. Those of us who have lived in this era will all come, maybe the North Americans in this area, then the North Americans from the West, then the Australians and then the British will all come. This is the 11th hour people. We'll either go to right or left, and he'll continue to work until he gets back right down to Adam, the first, who will be last. Won't it be interesting if you're on the right-hand side to watch what happens to Adam? See which side he goes to. Because he'll go to one or the other, as we all will. That is a very clear testimony, I believe, to what is about to happen to you and me. Now, you might say, why? Why would this be the case? Well, there are practicalities. Millions have been resurrected, the majority of them awaiting rejection. Many be called, but few chosen. It says at the end of verse 16 of chapter 20, for many be called, few chosen. So what about all these who are going to be rejected? The vast majority of those who lived in the times of Israel and Judah will be rejected. What about Israel under the kings who worship golden calves? What about them? Well, there were a few, we know. 7,000 hadn't bowed the knee to Baal in the time of Ahab. But they're a minority. You see, we talked about this, didn't we? Holding the raised dead in a state of frailty, albeit wholeness, just as they were, but in a state of frailty. Remember Daniel? He stood trembling. Daniel 10. That solves your problem, doesn't it? It solves the problem of the wild men of the past who will be at the judgment seat, who would make life difficult and uncomfortable for everybody if they were given free rein. Won't happen. So all of those generations who have died in the past, when they're raised, they'll be held in this state of frailty to secure control. That's why he starts with us. We're the first cab off the rank, brothers and sisters. Very practical reasons. As I said, it's all foreshadowed back there in Daniel chapter 10, verses 10 through 17. Now, what about the length of the judgment? This is always an issue, you know. We're going to talk about the 10-year period between the resurrection and Armageddon. And people say, oh, surely the judgment seat's not going to last for 10 years. Thankfully, no. The judgment seat will not last for 10 years. There are literally thousands of things that have got to be done in that 10 years, and judgment is just one small portion of it. So how long? Well, let's do a bit of calculation here, shall we? Just for the sake of exercising our mind. We calculate the time if Christ himself was to personally interview every individual, which he's not going to do, by the way. He's only going to speak one-liners. That's all he'll do. He'll just speak one-liners. When people come along who have been through the process and they know that they're going to be rejected, some of them will say, but Lord, Lord, did we not do this? And he will say, who are you? Never knew you. To my left. That's all he's going to say. Christ is not going to personally interview every person. The angels are going to do that, as we'll demonstrate in a moment. If he did, let's just say he did, and let's say there's 20 million responsible, that's probably too few. Well, let's just say, for argument's sake, 20 million responsible, and he gave them 1 minute per interview, it would take him 38 years if he worked 24/7, as they say. 38 years. Well, let's just cut the number back. Let's come back to 10 million, but a reasonable interview. I mean, you can't, a 1 minute interview is not enough, is it? Well, let's just say an hour. That'd be almost too long, but anyway, let's just say it's an hour. It would take him 1,142 years to get through 10 million. So Christ is not going to personally interview every individual. How long will the judgment process last anyway? Well, we've got a clue. You know, we just read this in our daily readings yesterday, didn't we? In Exodus chapter 40. Israel brought the materials of the tabernacle from Egypt. That's like you and I being taken out of Egypt for the purpose of judgment. They arrived at Sinai. You and I are about to arrive at Sinai. The materials are taken from Egypt. Our brother mentioned that in his prayer, did he not? And it took them 6 months to manufacture the parts and the pieces of the tabernacle. And then in one day, probably only an hour or two, the whole thing went up before Israel on the first day of the first month of the second year out of Egypt. He was there. It appeared out of nowhere, so to speak. And this wonderful, marvelous thing, which represented the beauty of the glorified Christ in its wholeness and fullness, was there, just like it will be, brethren and sisters, when Christ has gone through the process of sorting out sheep from goats. He will turn to the sheep on his right hand and say, Come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, we shall be changed, says Paul. All together, just like the raising of the tabernacle in the morning of the first day of the first month of the second year. So that's telling us something, isn't it? How long was it from the exit from Egypt to the raising of the tabernacle in all its glory? Less than 12 months. 11 and a half months. That's what it took. Strongly suggestive that the judgment seat itself will last less than 12 months. So what's going to happen in that 12 months? I want you to come to Romans chapter 14. Now, Romans 14, of course, is well known. It is that chapter which speaks of the problem that was in the ecclesia there, to most ecclesias actually, about two different attitudes. We won't go into that now, we're not going to talk about that problem, but about what Paul says in connection with where that leads to the judgment seat of Christ. In Romans chapter 14, verses 10 and 12, 10 to 12, he says this: But why dost thou judge thy brother, or why dost thou set at naught thy brother? For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ, it says in the Authorized Version. Does anybody have a translation in the room that says God? We've got one, two, there's a couple. Well, you're right, you know. If you've got the Authorized Translation and it says judgment seat of Christ, you should change it to God, because the Greek word is theos. Theos is God. Now, you might say, well, hang on, I don't want to change that yet. Well, just hold your pen for a while and read on. Read on to the next verse. For it is written, As I live, saith the Lord, and this is a quotation, brethren and sisters, from Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 23. It's where it's coming from. And back in Isaiah 45, 23, the word is Yahweh. As I live, saith Yahweh, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God. so you can safely change.
Verse 10, change Christ to God.
That's what it should be. Why did the translators of the Authorized Translation put Christ in there instead of God? What was their thinking, do you think? Well, it is the judgment seat of Christ, isn't it? Yes. No problem with that. They're right on that. But they should just have left it alone. You know why? This was meant to tell us something about the process at the judgment seat of Christ. Why doesn't it say Christ? Well, you see, this is about talking to someone, each one of us, talking to someone at the judgment seat. And who will we talk to? Not Christ. We will be talking to an angel, the representative of God, whom Christ will bring with him for the work of judgment. Now, we'll demonstrate that in a moment. It's quite plain that that's the case. So this is about the process of judgment leading up to our appearance before Christ, who will sort sheep from goats. So we've got to be prepared to come into his presence. And that preparation will be the work of the angels. We're going to sit down with each one of us, brethren and sisters, and do what this section of Scripture says has to be done. Now, some people find this difficult. I've had people come to me and say, "Oh, this sounds awful." Well, I'm sorry, it's not my idea. It's just what's here, and we need to confront it. We need to make it a reality and recognize it is going to happen like this. So what does Paul say here? He quotes Isaiah 45:23, and then he says this. Now, this is his summary. Verse 12 is a summary of verses 10 and 11. So then, he says, every one of us, and he means responsible people, these are the ones up here who are making judgments today. You won't be in the kingdom because you eat this or you don't eat that. See? Responsible people. So then every one of us shall give account of himself to God, he says. That word account that you can see in the yellow is the Greek word logos. And logos means the word spoken, an expression of the thoughts of the mind, an account or an exposition. Every one of us, he says, is going to give an exposition of himself to God. The word confess to God, up here in verse 11, is this Greek word, which you can see has got logio in the middle of it. Exomologio mei. Okay? And logio means to talk. It means to speak out and to confess fully. So what that's telling me is that there has to be a process, a time, in what we would call the judgment seat of Christ, which we know will be about 12 months, there has to be a time in there where we sit down and talk to someone. A divine representative. Everyone will fully confess to God. Now that doesn't sound very pleasant if what you've got to talk about is not all that good, does it? So we need to confront this, brethren and sisters. There'll be some brethren in the Roman Ecclesia who are going to be very embarrassed if they didn't listen to Paul, didn't listen to his advice, and kept on doing what they were doing with their brethren. They're going to be very red-faced because the angel's going to sit down and open up a book and say, "Now listen, I want to talk to you about this. Tell me something about it. Why did you do that? Why did you make that judgment? Etc., etc. Tell me about it." How do we know that this is true, brethren and sisters? What about Achan in Joshua chapter 7? Did not Joshua know what Achan had done? Of course he did. What did Joshua say to Achan? He said to him, "My son, confess. Tell us about it. Tell us what you did." He could have said, "Well, I've already told you." No, no, I want you to tell the whole nation what you did. Come on. So he brings it all out. He fully confesses and then gets stoned to death. Why? What's this about?
It's about the righteousness of God being revealed and manifested. And brethren and sisters, take this on board. Whether we are accepted or rejected, God is going to be glorified. That's why Paul quotes Isaiah 45:23. As I live, saith Yahweh, every knee shall bow to me and every tongue shall confess to God. And when he's finished, and it's going to take him 40 years, 50 years in fact, from our judgment to the time that every single person on earth bows the knee, God will be glorified. That's why Joshua said to Achan, give God the glory, my son. It's not about us, brethren and sisters. It's about God's righteousness, the judgment seat. That's what Paul's saying here. And there is a process that we have to pass through, every one of us. It cannot be escaped. It has to be faced. So let's just summarise this process of judgment, shall we? The angels raise the dead and transport to Sinai. The angels then collect the responsible living and transport them to Sinai. Just like they did to Lot and his wife, so it will happen to us. We can expect a knock on the door in the evening, brethren and sisters. It will come in the evening. Christ tells us that in Luke 17. In Luke 17, he talks about days and day, as it was in the days of Noah and the days of Lot. So shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. Then he says, day. So will it be in the day when the Son of Man cometh. 10 times. 5 in the plural. 5 in the singular. It's all about grace, really. God wants to extend the grace. And the days that we have now are like the days of Noah and the days of Lot. They're days of opportunity. It's divine grace being given to us. But there's coming a day. Day of judgment. Can be a day of grace. For Lot's wife, it won't be. Remember Lot's wife, he said. Then he says this. I tell you, in that night, there shall be two in one bed, husband and wife, both responsible. The one taken, paralambano, means to take into a marriage. And the other left, arphiami, means to put out of a marriage. Lot will go into the marriage. Lot's wife will go out of the marriage. She won't be part of the bride of Christ. Why does he change it tonight? Well, he's saying, look, I want you to go back and read Genesis 19. And Genesis 19 is telling you how it's going to happen. There's going to be a knock on the door. In the evening. Yes, we should say, come in, I've been waiting, Lord. And there'll be two angels at my house because I and my wife are both responsible to the judgment seat of Christ. And before morning has come, we will be gone. The next day, when the sun rises, we will be standing at Sinai. That's the reality of it. The angels will interview each responsible person. We'll see why in a moment. They will bring contemporary groups then before Christ's judgment throne, beginning with the final generation and working back to Adam. Now, how can we say that with confidence, brethren and sisters? I'll tell you how we can say it with confidence. Jesus said this. He says, what you have done privately in the closets will be revealed from the housetops. Now, if I went to the judgment seat with Abraham, for example, and I was rejected and my sins have been revealed and I'm sent to the left, Abraham wouldn't know me from a bar of soap, would he?
But if I go to the left in your company, that is a totally different matter. My embarrassment will be palpable because I spoke to you about these things. Got it? If we're rejected in the presence of those who know us, that's going to be very embarrassing.
That's how we know. So, brethren and sisters, we have all of this revealed. If you dig deep enough and hard enough, it's all there. Christ simply separates sheep from goats and weighs to the right and left respectively. Some object and claim better treatment. He gives them a one-line answer. I never knew you. And when all have appeared, Christ glorifies the righteous simultaneously, while those on the left, the greater number, are watching on. You will see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom, and you yourselves thrust out, he said, of the Esau types. So Esau and his company on the left will watch while the saints, the accepted saints on the right, are glorified. I'll tell you something that's not going to happen, brethren and sisters. There's not going to be silence like there is in this room right now. When that happens, there is going to be joy over on this side, on the right hand, like you have never seen before. And over here, on the left, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth like you've never seen before. That's the reality of it. And Christ then dismisses the rejected, and the angels perform one of their last works. They herd the rejected away into outer darkness, which means Europe, by the way. Now, I don't speak French very well. I don't want to be there. That is the process of judgment. I want you to come then and have a look. We're going to come to Matthew chapter 25 in a moment, but you're going to have a look at the work of the angels at the judgment seat. We read of them this. We're not going to go into all of these passages. We just don't have time for that, but you can jot them down if you wish and examine them. We read that the angels will accompany Christ when he returns as judge of the household. Now, there's a reason for that. We also know that the results of judgment are to be declared in their presence. The angels are going to be there as the audience when the declaration is made. And we also know from Matthew 13, 49 and 50 that they will remove and punish the rejected. You know, Brother Roberts actually creates a very vivid picture of people who are herded away from the judgment seat who say, oh, well, I'm going to defy Christ and try and jump over a cliff and end their life, you know, rapidly. He paints the picture in Nazareth Revisited that that won't be allowed to happen. If there's many stripes to be born, then many stripes will be born. You can jump off the cliff as much as you like, but the angel's going to make sure you're not killed. There'll be a soft landing. You're going to outer darkness. That's their last work, or one of them. Why would this be the case? Well, this is this well-known passage in Hebrews chapter 1. We don't even need to turn it up, do we? We know the passage, the last verse in Hebrews chapter 1, of the angels. Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation, declares Paul? What does he mean? Ministering is the Greek word liturgikos. We get liturgy from that, or at least the church does. It actually means public service, especially in the temple. Now, I used to be a public servant, and I can tell you something. I didn't do much serving of the public. But the angels are not like that. They're sent forth to minister in the temple, so to speak, in the house of God, the ecclesia. Sent forth, that's apostello. They're apostles. Dispatched on a mission. To minister. Two words in the Greek. Eis diakonia. With a view to service. Now think about that, brethren and sisters. When you got baptized, and maybe before, but certainly when you were baptized, Christ, who now sits at the right hand of the Father, looked around the vast array of angels who serve him and picks one of them out. He says, here, come here. There's a brother or a sister, will be a brother or a sister, getting baptized at Royal Oak this week. You're going to be their angel. It's your job. You're going to minister to this heir of salvation. And that angel from that day until the day their probation ends has a responsibility. He does everything in his power. He can't manipulate your thinking. The Bible does that. But he can manipulate circumstances. He does his absolute best, and if you're half intelligent, you will have seen the hand of the angel working in your life. Have you seen it? I've seen it in mine, and sometimes I work against it. doing his absolute best to get us into the kingdom. And he's doing something else. He's also recording. We'll talk about that in a minute too. He's recording because he's the one that's going to sit down and open up a book and interview us. And we're the ones who are going to speak. Nobody better than him who will know what we've done or haven't done during the course of our probation. He's got a good record. He's pretty close to the action. Okay, so that's what Paul means. Now, that's either that's either just words on a page, or it's real. And if it's real, then it's got to mean something to us, doesn't it? That's why the angels are at the judgment seat of Christ. So let's come to that chapter, Matthew 25, which was read for us this afternoon. Now, this is the third of three parables that conclude what we know as the Olivet Prophecy. Always bear this in mind, brethren and sisters and young people. This is not some separate delivery of parables. This is connected to the Olivet Prophecy. How do we know that? Well, just read the first verse of chapter 26 of Matthew. It says this, "And it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings." What sayings? Well, the ones that began back in chapter 24, verse 3. "And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy parousia, thy presence, and of the end of the age? And Jesus answered and said unto them." And so the sayings that end in chapter 26, verse 1, include the content of Matthew 25. How do we know that? Well, just have a look at Matthew 24, verse 45. Matthew 24, verse 45 says, "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household?" And by the way, the word household there is the Greek word therapia. And that's what the ecclesia should be, a place for therapy, spiritual therapy. That's what it should be. Okay, and we're stewards in that house to give spiritual therapy by feeding people with the Word of God. He goes on to say he's going to give them their meat, their food, in due season. Now, that verse is expanded in the three parables of Matthew 25. The parable in Matthew 25 of the wise and the unwise virgins, the 10 virgins, of verses 1 to 13, has a prominent word. What's the word? Wise. You find it four times in verse 2, verse 4, verse 8, and verse 9. Wise. Who then, he said in chapter 24, 45, is a faithful and wise servant? It's followed by another parable, isn't it? The parable of the talents. Guess what the dominant word is? Faithful. Verses 21 and 23. Four times this word is used. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. See? So he's expanding on what he said in chapter 24. So therefore, the third parable, that of the sheep and the goats, is going to expand on the last part of verse 45 of the previous chapter. Whom his Lord hath made ruler, that he's made him a steward, over his household to give them food in due season. It's about stewardship. And that's what the parable of the sheep and goats is about. It's about the outcomes of our stewardship. Now, some of us might be thinking, well, I can relax. Well, I'm not a steward. There's not a single person in this room who's not a steward of some kind. You might be an arranging brother. You might be a Sunday school teacher. You might be a mother raising children in the truth. You might be anything. If you have responsibilities in the ecclesia or the home, you are a steward. Not one of us can escape this. So you see, this parable is about the outcome of our stewardship in the therapia, in the ecclesia. Well, you know, some say, well, this is about the national judgment. Daniel chapter 7 is about the national judgment, brothers and sisters, not Matthew 25. If you have any doubts about that and you think that Brother Thomas said something different, come along, I'll give you four or five places in Eureka where he makes it quite plain that its primary meaning is about us as individuals. This is about you and me. So let's try and unravel it. Matthew 25, verse 31. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. Son of Man? What's that about? Well, I'll tell you something, brethren and sisters. That's not about his humanity. This is a title taken from Psalm 8 and Psalm 80, verse 17, which is drawn from Genesis chapter 1. Let them have dominion. The first Adam lost that dominion. The second Adam, called in Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4, the Bene Adam, the second Adam would restore it. That title, Son of Man, whenever you find it, and check me out, you'll read it 90-odd times in the book of Ezekiel. See if you can find one where it's about Ezekiel's humanity. You'll read it 85 times in the gospel records. See if you can find me one that's about his connection with humanity, his mortality. No. They're all about his delegated authority from God to exercise dominion over carnal things. Check it out. You'll find it to be the case. That's why he's called the Son of Man. That's why he's called the Son of Man in John chapter 5. God has given me, he says, authority to execute judgment because I am the Son of Man. The second Adam who restored dominion. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. So some think this has got to be the throne of David, the one that we made mention back in chapter 19 of Matthew, remember? Well, I'll tell you something, brethren and sisters. Christ is sitting in a throne right now at the right hand of his Father. Is that a throne of glory? Yes. When he comes and establishes a judgment throne, will that be a throne of glory? Yes. When he establishes the throne of David after Armageddon, will that be a throne of glory? Yes. Wherever he sits is a throne of glory. And you and I are going to recognise that when we come before him in a contemporary group and he waves to right or left. There'll be no doubt about what that throne's about. It says, before him shall be gathered all nations. Now, that doesn't mean everybody of every nation on earth. Of course, we know what that language means. It's used in places like Zechariah 14, verse 2. I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. Does that mean that the 193 nations of the UN are all going to be there? No. What it means is that there will be representatives of all nations there. Now, the disciples wouldn't have understood this, would they? They didn't have any idea about the gospel going to the Gentiles. So Christ is actually teaching them something. When the judgment seat comes, he says, you know, not just going to be Jews there. There's going to be a lot of Gentiles, people from all nations, and so it will be. He shall separate them the one from another as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats, which strongly suggests, of course, that the goats are more numerous. You have a flock of sheep and goats, and the goats are more numerous, and you want to separate the sheep from the goats. That's the easiest way to go, isn't it? Take the smaller number from the larger number. Strong suggestion there. Many called, few chosen. But you see, we actually choose ourselves. He doesn't really choose. We choose. Because we choose to be either a sheep or a goat. Now, both sheep and goats were used under the law for sacrifices. You could take a lamb or a kid of the goats and offer them a sacrifice. Both clean animals. But Christ says, there is a difference. It's in character. He's talking about people, all of whom are clean. That is, they're in covenant, as it were. They're clean. But they've got different characteristics. We want to talk about why he chooses sheep and goats, because there will be two classes at the judgment seat, not three, not four, not a dozen. You don't find donkeys here, or there will be some donkeys there, in fact, but you don't find donkeys there. You don't find an ass, do you? You don't find anything else, just sheep and goats. Why? Well, because of their characteristics. Sheep are dependent. Goats tend to be independent creatures. Sheep are very dependent on a shepherd. Goats want to be alone. Sheep are submissive. They hear the shepherd's voice, but goats are rebellious. Sheep are willing. Goats are uncaring, except for themselves. Sheep are obedient. Goats are disobedient. Sheep are gregarious. They love to be with their brothers and sisters, other sheep. But goats love to be solitary. See this goat here? He's up on a mountaintop, sniffing the breeze. He loves to be out doing his own thing, alone. Who cares about the brothers and sisters? Let them look after themselves. Sheep were normally white. In the Middle East, in Australia, they're grey. You know, we've got a shade of grey. They're white in New Zealand, by the way. White, of course, is the colour of righteousness, isn't it? Goats were normally black in the Middle East in the days of Christ. And sheep are selective eaters. They rely upon the shepherd to lead them beside the still waters and to the pastures that can nourish them. Whereas goats will eat almost anything. They'll chew on leather and tin cans. Whatever the world dishes up, I can handle it. You know, no matter where it comes from, I can handle that. Goat. It's pretty simple, isn't it? You do not need to be Albert Einstein to work that out. Now, is this right? Are we fair to goats, do you think? This is from a goat keeper. Goats are capricious. They are impulsive and unpredictable, devious and contrary. When they are grazing, it is not unusual to see several with their heads through a fence, straining to reach the grass that is always greener on the other side. If they are not poking their heads through fences, they may be standing on their hind legs, stretching for those tender leaves just out of reach. Goats are never content with what they have. That's a goat keeper. I could go on and on with quotations from goat keepers. You get bored after a while. What about sheep? Sheep are attentive. John 10:27. My sheep hear my voice, said Christ, and I know them, and they follow me. They're responsive. Isaiah 40:11. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom. They're willingly led. Psalm 23:2. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. Oh, they do occasionally stray. Isaiah 53:6, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. But the shepherd goes looking for them because he knows they're sheep. They're submissive, Isaiah 53:7. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb. So he openeth not his mouth. We could say a lot more about sheep and goats, brethren and sisters, but I think the point is clear, isn't it? There's not a, did you notice, there's not going to be anything in the middle. There's no she-oat there, half sheep, half goat, is there? You're either a sheep or you're a goat. Now most of us, if we're really honest with ourselves, know that occasionally we act like goats. We just need to make sure that before the end comes, we're acting like sheep. Because that's the basis of the judgment. Characteristics we choose. And this is the outcome. Matthew 25. We read in verse 33, and he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. And all he's going to do, brethren and sisters, as wave after wave of contemporary generations come, beginning with us and working back to Adam, all he's going to do is sit in the throne. And as the angels bring up a contemporary group, he just waves, perhaps with a smile. and all too often has to use his left arm, perhaps with a frown. Silence. Except for those who think this is just not right. But Lord, Lord!
Never knew you.
That's how it will be. Goes on to say in verse 34, then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, so he starts with them first, the accepted. When he's done the last work, Adam's come, Adam gets the result, goes to left or right. He turns to those on the right. Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Read Genesis 3. For I was hungry, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then the righteous answer him. Notice they're righteous. This is the ones in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 18. That the righteous scarcely be saved. They answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungry and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee, or sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer in verse 40 and say, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. You see, these are the people who were like him. He sets the sheep on the right and the goats on the left. And Psalm 16 verse 11 says, the words of Christ, thou wilt show me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore. That'll be true of us. At the right hand of Christ, these are those who are like him. John says we have no need to fear the judgment seat, because as he is, so are we in this world. We operate like him, the great steward. And the kindnesses he mentions in verses 35 to 36 are only those with which the Lord himself could fittingly identify. He couldn't say, brethren and sisters, when I was spiritually naked, you came and clothed me. When I was in a spiritual prison, which means sin, you came and released me. He couldn't say that, could he? Because he never was spiritually naked. He never was in prison through sin. He was never spiritually thirsty. His Father woke him up every morning, morning by morning. He spake in his ear. So he couldn't say that. But he can say these things because he was physically naked at times and physically hungry and physically thirsty and etc. Brother Carter says this. In commenting on this passage, he says, to feed a sick soul may have greater value than feeding a hungry body. To help the spiritually weary may fill a greater need than restoring physical vigor. I want you to notice something about this though, brethren and sisters. We just read verse 40. Read verse 45, because the same thing happens to those on the left, you see. Having glorified these on the right, he then turns to those on the left and says, well, when I was hungry, you didn't feed me, etc. And they said, but Lord, when did this happen? In verse 45, he says, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, he did it not to me. Did you notice the difference? There's a difference between verse 40 and verse 45, isn't there? In verse 40, those on the right, he says, to these, my brethren. But when he turns to those on the left, he says, these. There's no my brethren there. I wonder why. Weren't some of these, weren't many of these his brethren? Yes, they were. But he doesn't know them. They were in the ecclesial list. If you looked up the book, it said, Brother X, Sister Y, they belong to such and such an ecclesia. They're brothers and sisters.
Not anymore. He does not account them as his brethren anymore. And you know why some of them are there? Because of unfaithful stewardship. This is about stewardship. When I was spiritually naked, we could say of ourselves, he couldn't say that, but we can say that. You didn't come. You didn't operate as a steward. That's his point, isn't it? They've lost their brethren status, many of them, because of the failure of stewardship. Brethren and sisters, as time goes on, our responsibility as stewards increases every day. We are in trouble as a community. Make no mistake about that. And this world is eating the vitals out of the truth in too many people's lives. I know that's true. I've lost too many good friends in the last 10 or 15 years. People who I thought would never forsake the truth have walked away from it. There's not a day that passes I don't think about them. The need for stewardship is increasing every day. Will Christ find us as faithful stewards? Or will he find us as goats, chewing on what the world dishes up to the exclusion of our brethren? That's our challenge, isn't it? The next study, God willing, we're going to have a more pleasant task, a much more pleasant task. Because now these on the left have been dismissed and we can focus to ourselves, hopefully ourselves, on the right, and the invitation, come, my people, hide yourself for a moment.